10. The Meme's Eye Point of View. Words and Other Memes. I think that a new kind of replicator has recently emerged on this very planet. It is staring us in the face. It is still in its infancy, still drifting clumsily in its primeval soup, but already it is achieving evolutionary change at a rate which leaves the old gene panting far behind. The new soup is the soup of human culture. We need a name for the new replicator, a noun which conveys the idea of a unit of cultural transmission, or a unit of imitation. Richard Dawkins, The Selfish Gene. I am convinced that comparisons between biological evolution and human cultural or technological change have done vastly more harm than good, and examples abound of this most common of intellectual traps. Biological evolution is powered by natural selection, cultural evolution by a different set of principles that I understand but dimly. Stephen Jay Gould, Bully for Brontosaurus. Words exist in the manifest image, but what are they? Dogs are a kind of mammal or a kind of pet. What are words a kind of? They're a kind of meme, a term that Richard Dawkins coined in his book, The Selfish Gene, and is defined in the epigraph. Which kind of meme are words? The kind that can be pronounced. In addition to words, there are other lexical items, such as irregular plurals, and exceptions to the rules of a language that also have to be independently stored in memory. What is transmitted from other speakers to a novice speaker who picks up the irregular plural of child, for instance, is a lexical item. These are all paradigmatic memes, not innate features of language or grammar, but optional, culture-bound features that have to spread through linguistic communities, and they are often in competition with variants. Other memes, such as the meme for wearing your baseball cap backward or gesturing just so to indicate approval, or for building an arch that looks like this, also have no pronunciation and hence aren't words. What are memes a kind of? They are a kind of way of behaving, roughly, that can be copied, transmitted, remembered, taught, shunned, denounced, brandished, ridiculed, parodied, censored, hallowed. There is no term readily available in the technical language of the scientific image that aptly encapsulates what kind of a thing a meme is. Leaning on the ordinary language of the manifest image, we might say that memes are ways of doing something or making something, but not instincts, which are a different kind of ways of doing something or making something. The difference is that memes are transmitted perceptually, not genetically. They are semantic information, design worth stealing or copying, except when they are misinformation, which, like counterfeit money, is something that is transmitted or saved under the mistaken presumption that it is valuable, useful. And as we have seen, disinformation is design worth copying. Internet spam, like propaganda, is designed, after all. Who benefits? Sometimes the hosts, sometimes the authors, and sometimes the memes themselves, who may have no authors, but who, nevertheless, like viruses, who also have no authors, have their own fitness, their own relative replicative ability. Words are the best examples of memes. They are quite salient and well individualized as items in our manifest image. They have clear histories of descent with modification of both pronunciation and meaning that can be traced back thousands of years in many cases. They are countable. Think of vocabulary sizes, and their presence or absence in individual human vectors or hosts is detectable by simple test. Their dissemination can be observed, and now, thanks to the Internet, we have a fine laboratory in which more data can be gathered. As always in a lab, there are prices to pay in restricting the phenomena to a circumscribed artificial environment and in the risk of deep bias in the population of our experimental subjects. Not all language users are Internet users, obviously. It is no accident that the population of tokens of the meme species The term, founded by Dawkins in 1976, languished somewhat until the Internet provided an ideal niche for their use. If words are the best memes, why didn't Dawkins feature them prominently in his exposition? In fact, he began his chapter on cultural evolution by citing the accumulation of changes in English from Chaucer to the present. Language seems to evolve by non-genetic means, and at a rate which is orders of magnitude faster than genetic evolution. His first list of meme examples was tunes, ideas, catchphrases, clothes, fashions, ways of making pots or of building arches. Catchphrases are lexical items made of words, but Dawkins didn't stress the role of words in transmitting ideas, no doubt because ideas can be wordlessly shared and transmitted, showing something, not describing or defining something, for instance. And Dawkins wanted to highlight the unobvious extension of the concept of memes beyond words to other kinds of cultural things. Tunes, not necessarily songs with lyrics, fashions in clothing, whether or not there are names for them, and so forth. Terms like miniskirt and bow tie get spread, along with their exemplars, but so do unattended features that are only noted and subsequently named after they have multiplied many-fold. Wearing your baseball cap backward, jeans with rips in them, socks with sandals. The main enabling technology of genomics is PCR, the polymerase chain reaction that takes any sample of DNA and copies it so voluminously that it can be readily detected and distinguished and manipulated. Multiple copies of advertisements lined up on the walls of the escalators in the London Tube or plastered side by side on the temporary wooden walls around urban construction sites, hoardings in British English, catch the observer's eye by making an irresistible pattern. As always, repetition is a key ingredient in creating new affordances, whether it is arrayed synchronously in space like the advertisements or identical fragments of nucleic acid, or sequenced in time, like rehearsing a tune or a word, or noticing again and again and again the Eiffel Tower in the distance in Paris. Multiple copies of anything tend to enable your pattern recognition machinery to make yet another copy in the recognizer, and thus a meme can get spread. Imagine that words are shown as high on reproduction versus growth, high on culture versus genetic, and low on complexity. Perhaps if Dawkins had developed the theme of words as paradigmatic memes, he might have forestalled or softened some of the resistance his proposal encountered from other researchers of culture, historians, literary theorists, philosophers, linguists, anthropologists, and sociologists, for instance. They have never supposed that words, except perhaps for a handful of coined words, were deliberately designed creations. Since there has never been a myth of words as intelligently designed cultural artifacts, they would have had no vested interest in protecting such a myth and might well have been more open-minded to the suggestion that rather more elements of culture were like words than they had realized. In any event, we can make the point now and go on to note that once words are secured as the dominant medium of cultural innovation and transmission, they do begin to transform the evolutionary process itself, giving rise to new varieties of R&D much closer to the traditional mythical ideal of intelligent design. What's good about memes? The price we pay for our promiscuous lust for adaptive information is playing host to sometimes spectacularly pathological cultural variants. Richardson and Boyd, Not by Genes Alone. Among scientists researching cultural evolution, there has been something of an embargo against using Dawkins's term meme to refer to the ways of doing and making things that spread through cultures. But every theorist I can think of countenances such items under one term or another: ideas, practices, methods, beliefs, traditions, rituals, terms, and so on. These are all informational things that spread among human beings more or less the way germs or viruses do. Information is what cultural evolution, like genetic evolution, deals in. And, as Richardson and Boyd note, we need some expedient agreement about what to call the information stored in people's brains. This problem is not trivial, because psychologists have deep disagreements about the nature of cognition and social learning. When we talk about culturally evolved information, we seldom, if ever, are talking about bits, Shannon style, of information, and it would be good to have a general term for a salient hunk or morsel of information, a term to go alongside and contrast with gene. Since the word meme has secured a foothold in the English language, appearing in the most recent edition of the Oxford English Dictionary, defined as an element of culture that may be considered to be passed on by non-genetic means, we may conveniently settle on it as the general term for any culturally based way. Those who are squeamish about using a term whose identity conditions are still embattled should remind themselves that similar controversies continue to swirl around how to define its counterpart, gene, a term that few would recommend abandoning. So, bucking the tradition of shunning the word, I will persist in calling many of the items of culture memes, and will defend that terminology as we go along, since I think the contributions Dawkins's concept makes to our understanding of cultural evolution far outweigh any unfortunate connotations the term has acquired. Why did the concept of a meme acquire a bad reputation? It was thanks in part to some exaggerations put forward by some would-be memeticists who didn't do their homework, and in part to theorists who had already figured out some of the aspects of cultural evolution on their own and didn't want to give Dawkins undue credit by adopting his coinage when talking about their own theoretical work. There were also a few careful criticisms of aspects of Dawkins's account of memes, which we will look at in due course. But more influential, in my opinion, has been a frantic campaign of misbegotten criticism, an allergic reaction of sorts from scholars in the humanities and social sciences who were unnerved to see dread biology invading their sacred precincts. I will respond to the standard objections from this quarter in Chapter 11 after recounting some of the benefits of adopting the meme's eye point of view, and also respond to the serious objections. Chief among the insights that Dawkins's memes contribute to the study of cultural evolution are three conceptions. 1. Competence without comprehension. The designedness of some cultural items is attributable to no author or syndicate of authors, no architects, no intelligent designers at all. The undeniable cleverness or aptness of the arrangement of the parts is due entirely to natural selection. The differential replication of informational symbionts, whose hosts can be as clueless about their cleverness as butterflies are of the eye spots on their wings. Human beings often do appreciate the virtues of the ideas they eagerly spread, but this is, as we shall see, a mostly recent and entirely optional feature of much of cultural evolution. Human comprehension and approval is neither necessary nor sufficient for the fixation of a meme in a culture. 2. The fitness of memes. Memes thus have their own reproductive fitness just like viruses. As Dawkins put it, "What we have not previously considered is that the cultural trait may have evolved in the way that it has simply because it is advantageous to itself." Whether or not a meme enhances the reproductive fitness of its hosts, the human beings who adopt and use the designs they carry, natural selection of the memes themselves is doing the work. Memes can spread to fixation in a single decade and go nearly extinct in the same time frame, an evolutionary process much too swift to be discernible in any increase or decrease in human offspring. Even if all memes were mutualist symbionts, importable adaptations that do indeed enhance the reproductive fitness of their hosts, the speed of their spread could not be explained by this minuscule effect. 3. Memes are informational things. They are prescriptions for ways of doing things that can be transmitted, stored, and mutated without being executed or expressed, rather like recessive genes traveling silently in a genome. Marco Polo is thought to have brought the pasta meme to Europe from China. He didn't have to become a pasta chef to do this. All he had to do was disperse copies of the meme in environments where other human beings could become infected by it, and express it in their ways of behaving. Traditional theories of cultural change in the humanities and social sciences have often struggled without these ideas. Old-fashioned Durkheimian functionalism, for instance, uncovered many highly plausible functions and purposes of social arrangements, taboos, practices, traditions, social distinctions, and so forth, but was unable to explain how these effective arrangements came into existence. Was it due to the cleverness of the kings, chieftains, or priests, a gift from God, or just luck? Or was it some mysterious group mind or shared genius of the people that appreciated these features and thereupon led to their adoption? You don't get teleology for free, and the Durkheimians had no defensible way of paying their debts. But no magical mechanism need be postulated. Natural selection of memes can do the design work without any obligatory boost from human, divine, or group comprehension. As David Sloan Wilson points out, functionalism died out for lack of a credible mechanism. The theory of meme evolution by natural selection can provide the needed mechanism just as plate tectonics provided the needed mechanism for the hypothesis of continental drift to be taken seriously. Another difficulty with traditional theories of culture is that they tend to settle on psychological categories for their informational entities, ideas or beliefs in particular. But although ideas and beliefs, however we want to characterize them as mental or psychological states or episodes, obviously play a big role in human culture. Not all cultural transmission and evolution depends on anything like conscious uptake. A group may imperceptibly shift its pronunciation of a word or execution of a gesture or way of applying plaster to walls, taking no notice of the drift. Even the meanings of words can evolve by processes quite outside the ken of those using the words, thanks to differential replication. Today, when somebody says enthusiastically, "That was an incredible lecture, simply terrific," they don't mean they didn't believe it, but nonetheless found it terrifying. Nobody decided to adjust these meanings or even approved the trend. It just happened by a shift in the population of tokens produced in the culture. The fact that changes in cultural features can spread without notice is hard to account for, and hence likely to be overlooked, when one adopts the traditional psychological perspective of ideas and beliefs. The meme's perspective provides a valuable corrective to this oversight, but much more important is the way memes can provide an alternative vision of how culture-born information gets installed in brains without being understood. The problem with the standard view is that it relies uncritically on the assumption of rationality that is built into the intentional stance. The default presumption of folk psychology is that people, and even higher animals, will understand whatever is put before them. Novel ideas, beliefs, concepts are, almost by definition, understood ideas, beliefs, concepts. To have an idea is to know what idea you have, is to conceive of it clearly and distinctly, as Descartes said. We hardly notice that whenever we try to identify an idea to discuss or consider, we identify it by its content, not, for instance, as the first idea mentioned by Tom or the idea I keep right next to my idea of baseball. This is a ubiquitous application of the pre-Darwinian notion that comprehension is the source of competence, and it is important that we invert the idea so that we can at least sketch, for the first time, an account of how uncomprehending competences can gradually yield comprehension. A task for Chapter 13. traditional theorists of culture tend to overestimate the contribution of individual artificers, imagining that they must have had more comprehension of the designs they invent, transmit, and improve than need be the case. Comprehension is not even necessary for design improvement. In a study of the evolution of the Polynesian canoe, Rogers and Ehrlich cite a passage by Alain, a French philosopher, writing about fishing boats in Brittany, not Polynesian canoes. Every boat is copied from another boat. Let's reason as follows in the manner of Darwin. It is clear that a very badly made boat will end up at the bottom after one or two voyages and thus never be copied. One could then say, with complete rigor, that it is the sea herself who fashions the boats, choosing those which function and destroying the others. The boat builders may have theories, good or bad, about what would be an improvement in the craft their fathers and grandfathers taught them to build. When they incorporate these revisions in their own creations, they will sometimes be right and sometimes wrong. Other innovations may simply be copying errors, like genetic mutations, unlikely to be serendipitous improvements, but once in a blue moon advancing the local art of boat building. The boats that come back get copied. The rest are consigned to oblivion, a classic case of natural selection at work. The copied boats may pick up gratuitous but harmless elements, decorations in effect, in addition to their genuinely functional adaptations. At a later date, these merely decorative elements may acquire a function after all, or they may not. The mimetics perspective can thus accommodate both functional and merely traditional embellishments to artifacts, rituals, and other human practices, and account for our inability to draw a bright line distinguishing between the two categories without any recourse to the inscrutability of the folk genius that created them. No comprehension is required, even if it probably accelerates R&D processes more often than it retards them. Yet another shortcoming of much traditional thinking about culture is the tendency to concentrate on the good stuff and ignore the junk. Adopting an economic model of culture is appropriate as a first approximation of the obviously useful, or just benign, elements of a culture. Its technology, science, art, architecture, and literature, its high culture, in short. These are indeed a society's treasures, and it makes good economic sense, it is rational, to preserve and maintain these things, to spend whatever it takes to sustain them, and make sure that they get passed along to the next generation as a handsome legacy, even if it takes years of arduous instruction and rehearsal to keep them alive and well over the centuries. But what about the malignant, useless, burdensome, fitness-reducing elements of a culture? What about those elements not appreciated by anybody, really, but too costly to eradicate, like the cold virus and malaria? The meme perspective covers both extremes and the middle. In fact, via the tripartite distinction from biology between mutualist, commensal, and parasitical symbionts. As I noted in Chapter 7, many people are repelled by the idea that memes are like viruses because they believe, mistakenly, that viruses are always bad for us. Not at all. In fact, only a tiny minority of the trillions of viruses that inhabit each of us right now are toxic in any way. It is not yet known for sure if some viruses are actually good for us or even obligate mutualists like the microflora in our gut, without which we would die. Do we need some viruses in order to thrive? Perhaps. We certainly need lots of our memes. Daniel Defoe's Robinson Crusoe is a veritable encyclopedia of the memes one needs to get by, and, a nice historical twist, the average 18th century adult probably was better equipped with memes for such a self-reliant life than the average 21st century adult from the developed world. How many of us know how to gather seeds for next year's planting, kindle fires without butane lighters, or fell trees? Can genuinely parasitic memes really thrive? A positive answer to this question was one of the most arresting points in Dawkins's introduction of memes. and probably this accounts for much of the antipathy for memes. Dawkins seemed to be saying to many readers that all culture is some horrible sickness, an infection of the brain, provoking self-destructive activity. That was not what he was saying. An egregious case of this mistaken presumption is found in David Sloan Wilson, who clearly sees the need for an evolutionary foundation for culture. The success of some social experiments and the failure of others on the basis of their respective properties constitutes a process of blind variation and selective retention operating during the course of recent human history, in addition to the distant evolutionary past. But he peremptorily dismisses memes because he thinks they are parasitic, so he never considers the possibility that memes might provide an evolutionary account for some cultural phenomena, religions in particular, more effectively and testably than his own multi-level group selection hypothesis. In fact, he cannot see that he himself on occasion alludes to memes. For instance, he finds it useful to characterize catechisms as cultural genomes, containing in easily replicated form the information required to develop an adaptive community. And on other occasions, he simply fails to notice that memetic alternatives to his hypotheses, such as my account in Breaking the Spell, are not only available, but more plausible. Many memes, maybe most memes, are mutualists, fitness-enhancing prosthetic enhancements of our existing adaptations, such as our perceptual systems, our memories, our locomotive and manipulative abilities. If there weren't mutualist memes from the outset, it is hard to see how culture could have originated at all. More on that origin later. But once the infrastructure for culture has been designed and installed by an interplay between cultural and genetic evolution, as we shall find out, the possibility of parasitical memes exploiting that infrastructure is more or less guaranteed. Richardson and Boyd call such memes rogue cultural variants. To take the obvious recent example of such a phenomenon, the Internet is a very complex and costly artifact, intelligently designed and built for a most practical or vital purpose. Today's Internet is the direct descendant of the ARPANET, funded by ARPA, now DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, created by the Pentagon in 1958 in response to the Russians beating the United States into space with its Sputnik satellite. And its purpose was to facilitate the R&D of military technology. Today, spam and porn, and cat photos and other Internet memes, dwarf any high-tech design sharing by Pentagon-funded labs. Before settling on the handy stereotype of such junk as examples of memes that don't enhance human fitness, we should remind ourselves of what fitness means in the context of evolutionary biology. Not health or happiness or intelligence or comfort or security, but procreative prowess. Which memes actually make their bearers more likely to leave more grandchildren than average? Very few, it seems. And many of our most cherished memes are demonstrably fitness-reducing in the biological sense. Getting a college education, for instance, has such a striking fitness-reducing effect that if, say, eating broccoli had a similar-sized effect, it should probably carry a public health warning. Caution! Eating broccoli is likely to reduce your number of surviving grandchildren to below average. When I ask my students if this striking fact alarms them, they deny it, and I believe them. They think there are more important things in life than out-reproducing their conspecifics, and their attitude is, if not quite universal, the prevailing view of all humanity. That fact, by itself, sets us apart from all other species. We are the only species that has managed to occupy a perspective that displaces genetic fitness as the highest purpose, the summum bonum of life. The quest for progeny is why birds build nests and beavers build dams. It's why whales migrate tens of thousands of miles and some male spiders rush to their deaths in the embrace of their mates. No salmon fighting their way upstream can reconsider and contemplate a life of learning to play the violin instead. We can. We are the only species that has discovered other things to die for and to kill for. Freedom, democracy, truth, communism, Roman Catholicism, Islam, and many other meme complexes. Memes made of memes. Like all living things, we are born with strong biases in favor of staying alive and procreating, manifest in the all but irresistible urges of our animal nature, and a host of more subtle habits and dispositions. But we are also the persuadable species, not just learners like birds and monkeys, and not just trainable like dogs or horses and lab animals under strict regimes, but also capable of being moved by reasons, reasons represented to us, not free-floating. We have already seen, in the castle-building termites and stotting antelopes, examples where there are reasons but not the organism's reasons. When animals do things for reasons, their comprehension of those reasons, of why they are doing what they are doing, is either non-existent or quite limited, as revealed in a host of experiments demonstrating their inability to generalize, to use what they at first appear to understand in novel variations or wider contexts. We, in contrast, don't just do things for reasons. We often have reasons for what we do in this sense. We have articulated them to ourselves and have endorsed them after due consideration. Our understanding of the reasons we can cite for acting as we do may often be imperfect, confused, or even self-deceived. But the fact that we can own these reasons, wisely or foolishly, makes us susceptible to being talked out of them and talked into others. When we have our minds changed, as we say, by some persuasion, possibly self-administered, there is always the possibility that our acknowledgement and acquiescence in the revision of our reasons won't really be taken to heart, in spite of what we say on the spur of the moment. The lesson may not have the long-term effect on our convictions and attitudes that was sought by the persuader or teacher. That is why we rehearse and revise and re-explain and retest and review our reasons. In the practice of reason-giving and reason-taking and rejecting, highlighted by Wilfred Sellers. Aristotle distinguished our species as the rational animal, and Descartes and many others, up to the present day, have attributed our talent as reasoners to a special res cogitans, or thinking thing, implanted in our brains by God. If our rationality isn't God-given, how could it evolve? Mercier and Sperber argue that the individual human being's capacity to reason, to express and evaluate logical arguments, arises out of the social practice of persuasion, and it shows fossil traces, in effect, of this origin. The notorious confirmation bias is our tendency to highlight the positive evidence for our current beliefs and theories while ignoring the negative evidence. This and other well-studied patterns of errors in human reasoning suggest that our skills were honed for taking sides, persuading others in debate, not necessarily getting things right. Our underlying talent favors decisions that are easy to justify but not necessarily better. The evolutionary process of R&D that could design such a skill would necessarily depend on some prior, if inchoate, skill in language use. So we may think of it as a co-evolutionary process, part cultural evolution and part genetic evolution, with the cultural evolution of pronounceable memes, words, leading the way.